From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up today on the show, we'll hear about recent developments in the struggle over a proposed pipeline from the Utah-Nevada border to Las Vegas. We'll be joined by Steve Erickson of the Great Basin Water Network.
So we think it's a poster child for all of the wrong practices that need to be adjusted, and that we've got to take a new look at how we're going to cooperate as a region in utilizing the limited resources we've got for water, including the Colorado River. So we need to revisit some of those issues and try to come up with a better way to approach our water future here in the West.
That, your Better Utah legislative recap, a look at the possibility that Google Fiber will make its way to Salt Lake City, and more just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later on the show, we're going to have a conversation with Steve Erickson of the Great Basin Water Network about some recent news having to do with the proposed pipeline from the Utah-Nevada border to Las Vegas. But first up, we have these headlines and your Better Utah legislative recap. Google Fiber, a high-speed fiber optic internet service, might change the way you access the internet in Salt Lake City in the coming years. Representatives from the internet giant joined Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker for a press conference on Wednesday morning, announcing that Google will investigate whether expanding Google Fiber to Salt Lake City is a possibility. Here's Kevin Lowe, general manager of Google Fiber, explaining some of the benefits of fiber optic internet access in a video released by the company.
Internet speeds matter. We all know the frustrations of waiting for your favorite website or video to load. And that's why Google Fiber wants to bring internet that's 100 times faster than basic broadband to more communities.
Salt Lake is among 34 cities across the country Google is considering as potential expansion sites for its high-speed internet and cable television service. If Google selects Salt Lake City for the service, the company says it would pay for the infrastructure needed to complete the project on its own. In a press release on Wednesday, Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker said he was excited to begin to lay the foundations of economic development for the future of Salt Lake City. For local internet services provider Pete Ashdown, founder of the company X Mission, the move by Google would present serious competition.
It would devastate a large portion of our business. Anyone in Salt Lake City that has a 5 megabit connection could then get it for free from Google.
Ashdown himself has been advocating for fiber optic networks in the community for some time.
It's a great market opportunity for fiber to roll into. And I've been advocating for that since about 2000. I personally would prefer to see an open municipal network that would encourage competition rather than yet another large monopoly installed. And the thing that people have to remember is that what Google is rolling out is a network that you can only subscribe to Google on.
Ashdown also expressed some concerns about privacy, saying that Google is largely in the business of selling advertising based on tracking consumer habits. The next steps in this process, according to Google, are for the company to work side by side with city leaders on a two-part joint planning process. The first step involves completing a fiber-ready checklist, and the second, a detailed study of factors that affect construction plans, such as topography, housing density, and the condition of local infrastructure. The company says it will provide an update on which cities will get Google Fiber by the end of this year. And one end note to this story, for full disclosure, we should note that the internet services provider X Mission is an underwriter of KCPW Radio. Utah wildlife officials have opened an investigation into the case of a mountain lion that appears to have been killed by rocks. The Daily Herald of Provo reports that a small mountain lion was found in Payson by a man and his daughter who were hiking in a canyon area. Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Conservation Officer Sean Bagley says the father saw a group of youngsters near the dead mountain lion. Bagley says the man yelled at them, but that they ran away. Officer Bagley says an examination of the animal revealed he had been killed by large rocks. He called it an unacceptable act and says the division wants the people responsible to be held accountable. State wildlife officials say people can provide information about the crime anonymously to the agency's tip line. A meeting of the House Natural Resources, Agriculture, and Environment Committee on Tuesday saw one Utah lawmaker working to change the state's definition of what constitutes an air contaminant. In particular, Republican Representative Jerry Anderson of Price thinks the state shouldn't concern itself with the carbon dioxide emissions that are largely responsible for global climate change. Anderson's bill would define as non-contaminants the, quote, natural components of the atmosphere.
Everybody in elementary science knows that the plants need carbon dioxide. That's not a contaminant for them, and out here in this Western country, we're actually short of carbon dioxide for the growth of plants. So this bill just simply defines the atmosphere, the normal atmosphere, as non-contaminants.
Anderson, a retired science teacher, also said any global cap on atmospheric CO2 should be allowed to go as high as 500 parts per million, offering this explanation.
The carbon dioxide level back in the days of the dinosaurs was considered to be about 600 parts per million, and they seem to thrive quite well. Very large bodies, and the vegetation back in those times was lush. There were a lot of huge trees that made coal for us in these days. So I'm thinking that we could double the carbon dioxide rate and not have any adverse effects that I can tell.
The bill was widely supported by committee members, though during public comments, some concern was expressed that the legislation was walking a fine line with its description of natural components. Here's Utah Division of Air Quality Director Bryce Bird.
We do have some concerns with the language as it stands now because of the issue of natural components of the atmosphere. For almost every pollutant that we regulate coming from sources that we regulate, there are also natural sources of those pollutants. Just for example, cyanide is a natural component of the atmosphere. It can be generated through a natural process, and so it could be found in what would be considered natural air. Hydrogen sulfide, there's a whole list. Just about everything that we regulate from a combustion process could be found in the natural atmosphere as well, not coming from a human source.
Retired University of Utah engineering professor Joe Andrade was particularly worried about the 500 parts per million reference and CO2.
So yes, it's not toxic to you and me in concentrations below perhaps 1,000 or 2,000 parts per million, but it's toxic to this planet. So setting an arbitrary upper limit, which is out of the bounds of anything related to planetary stability, is simply bad government.
In the end, the bill ended up being held for revisions, not because of anything having to do with carbon dioxide or climate change, but because of references to naturally occurring elements such as radon and xenon with health implications for humans. The bill is slated to be heard again with revisions sometime later this week. And that does it for our day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. And now we'll turn to our daily legislative recap with Marianne Martindale, executive director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for a Better Utah. Marianne, you've been up on the Hill today, again, as you always are. I know that you were looking, for example, at a child sex abuse education bill this morning.
Yeah, that was first up, 7:30 in the morning, which is really early to get to the Hill.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we sat there for about an hour and a half. The committee was late, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. So HB 286, it's called Child Sex Abuse Education. This is by Angela Romero. Passed out of the committee unanimously. It's a great bill. This is going to provide a program that would educate children and educators about safety, inappropriate behavior, appropriate behavior, who to go to if something happens that you're uncomfortable with. Really good presentation on this and the value of it. Elizabeth Smart and her father, Ed Smart, both spoke in committee in favor of this. Very passionate speeches, as you can imagine. You know, Elizabeth was very eloquent and, you know, restated a lot of the things that I know we've all heard, but just how difficult it was. But one of the points that she and her father both made is that she was completely unprepared for what to do in this setting. Could she have done something when he first came into her room? Should she have screamed? You know, all these different things that you don't. They'd never even discussed the possibility of this. They'd never discussed what was okay and what was not okay. And then also the feelings that she was left after it happened, that this somehow she had caused this, that this was her fault. And so this education program is to teach kids that, you know, it's not them. It's the perpetrator. And maybe some ways to avoid behaviors or some of the early behaviors that can happen in settings to hopefully keep this from happening.
But it's also about them being able to identify what constitutes sex abuse, for example.
Right. If you're uncomfortable with something, what does that mean? And what should you do? You know, who should you talk to? And these are some of the adults that you can trust with that kind of information. And just giving them a sort of a safety net and the right words and how to articulate what it is that they're uncomfortable about. So it's, you know, it's still got a long ways to go. I mean, but it passed unanimously out of this committee, and, you know, hopefully it'll do the same thing the entire way. But it's a good step. This is going to be an important bill to help kids, I think.
And you're not foreseeing any opposition to it, or was there any opposition to it today?
You know, there was mild opposition. There were a couple people who spoke against it, mostly in terms of, you know, the parents' rights. One woman was worried about them, you know, talking about inappropriate things maybe in front of her children. Mm. But the key point for people to understand about this bill is there's an opt-out. Just like there was 2 years ago in the sex ed bill, we already have an abstinence only sex ed, but you can opt out of that as a parent. You can opt out of this if you don't feel that this is something you want your children to learn. Opt out. They send home a thing. You have to sign it before the child has this education. So you almost have the option to do that.
The parental option. In completely different news here, there's been some recent developments on the Medicaid expansion front. Governor Gary Herbert this morning reiterated in his monthly news conference that he is siding with doing something, that doing nothing is not on the table, that he's going to accept some form of Medicaid expansion, essentially. Kind of challenging Speaker Lockhart there.
Right, because Speaker Lockhart, of course, just before that, yesterday, essentially, in her press conference, said they came out and presented this new sort of a plan. I mean, we still have yet to see the bill that supposedly goes with this and to really understand what the plan is. But it's a very, very truncated state-based plan. It would cost something like $30, $35 million of state money, totally ignoring the federal money, leaving that on the table, even though that's taxpayer money that's already allocated, turning their back on any federal option, creating our own thing. But it would serve a much, much smaller percentage of those people who fall into this Medicaid gap. For example, I think that the number they were quoting was maybe as high as 50,000 at the most. We know there's 123,000 Utahns that need insurance and would get it through the full expansion. Mm. So it's a little tiny scratch on the surface. It's trying to create some sort of state-based model. It's a political statement, and it's unfortunate because, I mean, that's really not a Utah value.
You know, it's interesting. Governor Herbert this morning called it illogical to not accept the money that Utahns have been paying into the
right,
system.
Right. We don't get a rebate for that money. If we don't do Medicaid expansion and take those up to $500 million of federal money to do this over the course of the next several years, we don't get that money back. That's allocated money. That's coming from the taxes already. Medicaid expansion isn't going away. Obamacare isn't going away. I mean, they keep sort of hoping that that's going to be, well, if we dig our heels in the sand, this is somehow going to change. But all the money that we've paid into this, the federal government is not going to write us a check and say, here, do your own thing. That's just not the way this works. So we're turning our back on money that's our money. Hmm. We're letting that go to other states who have decided to expand, Arizona, for example. And instead, we're willing to also spend additional funds to create our own whatever this sort of, I would not even call it a hybridized model. I mean, it's really just a very small extreme care and very, very low, below the poverty level group that this is going to help.
But Speaker Lockhart's argument is that it is a Utah model, and therefore, inherently, we have more control over it.
Right. And it was interesting. She also said that this is not a political statement, which I think is disingenuous, considering what, you know, we're pretty sure that her aspirations are to run against Governor Herbert in a couple of years. I'll tell you what it's not. It's not humane and it's not compassionate. And ultimately, that's not a Utah value.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that today. Marianne, thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for Better Utah. She joins us daily during the legislative session for our Better Utah Legislative Recap. And now on the rundown, we're going to turn to a conversation with Steve Erickson, Utah Coordinator for the Great Basin Water Network. And we're going to take a look at recent developments in the proposed pipeline from the Utah-Nevada border to the city of Las Vegas. Erickson's water network is one of a number of plaintiffs in a Nevada court case seeking to stop the Department of the Interior's approval of that project. Steve Erickson, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So there's new action over the proposed pipeline that would bring water from the Utah-Nevada border to Las Vegas. What's going on there?
A coalition of organizations headed by the Great Basin Water Network sued the Department of Interior over the decision by the BLM to grant a right-of-way for the pipeline project and to approve the overall groundwater development in that part of the country. So we believe that the BLM erred in making this record of decision. They essentially rejected their own science and their own findings on the dramatic and devastating impacts that this project would inflict upon the landscape and the wildlife and the people who live there.
When did the BLM make that decision, that record of decision?
It was sometime in December of 2012.
Okay. This comes in the wake of a couple of recent decisions, one by Governor Herbert and one by a Nevada state court. Governor Herbert's decision last year was to not sign the water sharing agreement, and then the Nevada court decision voided water rights that had been granted to the Southern Nevada Water Authority. Why is this new action needed? Aren't those decisions enough?
Well, those decisions certainly were important, and they have thrown a major roadblock into the progress of this project. But it's our feeling that we can't let up. There's still a driving force there in Las Vegas to go forward with the groundwater development and pipeline. And so this is yet another part of our arsenal in legally challenging this project. We've previously sued in state court, sued the state engineer for the award of water rights for the water that would go into the pipeline. Hmm. This latest decision by the district court in Nevada voided all of the water rights that were previously granted by the state engineer. So right now they don't have any water, nothing to put into a pipe and ship down to Las Vegas.
Is the thinking kind of, though, that if, you know, because they have the approval to build the pipeline and the right-of-way over land, that if they were to begin doing that, or if they started the sort of wheels in motion, that it would be harder and harder to undo?
Yes, absolutely. And they have appealed the court decision, Judge Estes' decision in the 7th District of Nevada. And we'll see how that appeal goes. We'll probably see the Supreme Court of Nevada make a ruling sometime in the next 12 to 24 months. But we really don't know when that decision will come down. We anticipate that there may be some water rights that are restored if the engineer can meet some of the hurdles that the court has put in front of it. But it may be an insufficient quantity to fill the pipe. That remains to be seen. In the meantime, we do have the opportunity to go to federal court to reverse the decision by the BLM and the Department of Interior. We also have some issues with the way that the Bureau of Indian Affairs handled the responsibilities, their trust responsibilities to the tribes in the region, the Goshute tribe and a couple of bands of Shoshone. Mm-hmm. So those issues are going to be pretty weighty for the courts to deal with. And so we're optimistic. We think we've got a strong case on the federal side. Mm-hmm. Certainly, we're pleased that Governor Herbert decided not to sign the agreement. We felt that that would have been extremely premature and would have green-lighted much of the project that right now has been halted by the courts. And I'm sure Governor Herbert's pleased that the courts have essentially found on our side in this case so far.
You know, one of the worries about this project is that in addition to the effects out in the West Desert or Great Basin, that the move would have some pretty drastic impacts here along the Wasatch Front, where the majority of our population in the state is. Maybe you could explain that for us.
It could very well. Snake Valley is a very lightly populated valley. It's also got a lot of alkali soils that are held together by greasewood plants. These greasewood plants have long root systems that go down to tap the underground water. And if you export the water and the water table drops, then eventually it goes below the level that the tap roots of these greasewood plants can reach. Mm-hmm. That means the plants die. And if the plants die, the landscape becomes denuded and the dust will be picked up by the strong winds that blow out in that part of the desert and could be transported into Salt Lake, particularly during the spring times when we do sometimes see dust storms coming off of the West Desert and the Salt Flats. This would increase the frequency and the severity of those kinds of events where our skies get blackened out by dust. And we've already got problems finding attainment with the EPA standards for dust for PM 2.5 and PM 10, which are the particulate matters that we worry most about during the wintertime. But in the springtime, they're also high levels when we get these dust storms.
I know that there was a recent study actually that looked at the effect of dust on our snowpack and therefore our water supply as well, correct?
Yes, and one of the top researchers in the country on that was Tom Painter, who was at the University of Utah for a while, did much of his best work in the mountains in Colorado, but is now working for Jet Propulsion Laboratories out in California. Mm-hmm. Dr. Painter and others who've studied snowpack albedo, which is the reflectivity of the snow, have found that if you put dust or dirt on top of the snow, It increases the absorptive character of the snow. Rather than reflecting the sunlight, it will absorb it, and that means a faster melt of the snowpack and a faster runoff. That presents problems because we need to have an orderly runoff in the late spring so that we can capture that water in reservoirs. If it runs off too early, too quickly, it can seep into the ground and not make it to the reservoirs, or we get flooding problems that we don't capture that water as effectively. So there are some concerns that not only would this cause problems for catching the water and saving it for the summer when we'll need it, but it also could shorten the ski season, which could have significant financial implications for the resorts and certainly is no fun for those of us who like to ski.
You know, you have a pretty sizable list of plaintiffs on this suit, including the Confederated Tribes of the Goshute Reservation, a number of environmental and community groups, even some here in Salt Lake. How was that coalition put together?
Well, it's been an interesting process beginning back in about 2004, 2005, when Southern Nevada Water Authority announced that they were going to revive this project that had been on the shelf between 1989 and 2002 or so, when the drought hit big time in this part of the country. And it was an interesting combination of a lot of old MX veterans, those of us who fought the MX missile system back in the early 80s.
And this was a missile system that would have been out in the West Desert circulating trains to launch missiles. Is that correct?
Yeah, something to that effect. It eventually wound up being trucks or these transporter erector systems for the largest missile in our arsenal at the time. And in any event,
We don't have to go too deep into
that. No, that's old history for some. But the coalition was comprised originally of these old MX veterans, the ranchers who live in Snake Valley and in Spring Valley in particular. But then the tribes were on board from the very beginning. We have business people, local governments. Right now, they're also part of our lawsuit, the Central Nevada Regional Water Authority. These are other water purveyors in the rural counties, and there are eight counties represented in that group that are part of our litigation against the Department of Interior.
That's
so it's almost like you've got all of the interest in rural Nevada lined up against the interest in Las Vegas.
Well, that's what I was about to ask, and that must be an interesting dynamic for political entities in the state. But the suit has been filed in the district court in Las Vegas. The intent is to void. This is just a reminder again, the BLM's approval of this project. When will it be heard? What happens if you win, and what happens if you lose, if you can answer those questions?
We're a little unsure about the timing on all of this. We haven't had a scheduling conference yet, so we don't know exactly when the time frames or mileposts on this will be hit. But we can anticipate we'll be looking at going to court sometime this year to argue the oral case. And then how long it'll take the courts to decide is up to the courts. We'd imagine that we'll know something on the outcome by the end of the year or sometime early next year, perhaps. If we win, we would guess that the BLM would have to go back to square one and redo the EIS or issue what's known as a supplemental environmental impact statement. Now, they would continue to perhaps rely upon some of the research they did in the previous environmental impact study, which took some, I guess it was close to 5 years, 4 years, I believe. This could set the project back on in timing considerably. It could also force a real reexamination of whether or not this project is needed. Well, we've argued that it isn't, and that Las Vegas doesn't really have the financial wherewithal to spend the $15 billion it's going to cost to build this project out. And we anticipate that people aren't going to want to pay that kind of money for that water. It's awfully expensive water. If we lose, then we still are in a position where there's no water to put into the pipeline, even if it were built. So if the courts green light the project and say, well, the BLM has made the right decision, they still have to go back, Southern Nevada Water does, and obtain the water rights. There remains the question of what happens with an agreement. Will we begin renegotiating, or will Nevada take Utah to the U.S. Supreme Court? Those are very much up in the air at this time.
A lot of questions still remaining, but you guys are pursuing this action. Hey, one final question I have is this sort of, you know, the canary in the coal mine when it comes to the future of water struggles in the West?
Well, we hope so. We think it's a poster child for all of the wrong practices that need to be adjusted, and that we've got to take a new look at how we're going to cooperate as a region in utilizing the limited resources we've got for water, including the Colorado River. So we need to revisit some of those issues and try to come up with a better way to approach our water future here in the West. We can guess that global warming is going to continue to make it more difficult, that water supplies are going to become more stretched, and the river is going to have less water in it over time. So we've got to get on top of this, and simply taking water from here and moving it over there to promote more development is not the answer. We've got to do some serious conservation. We're in this for the long haul as a society and as people who love to live in the West. We've now got to readjust our thinking and our habits and our practices.
Steve Erickson of the Great Basin Water Authority, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And thanks once more for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation with University of Utah filmmaker Paul Larson. His new film, Spirituality for the Uninsured, explores the many facets of human spirituality. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.